In 2022, Team Milk came together by sponsoring female marathon runners for the marathon in New York City. Today, they're more than 20,000 strong. In 2024, Team Milk is making an even bigger commitment to female runners and launching the only women's marathon in the U.S. designed for and by women. The inaugural Every Woman's Marathon will take place in Savannah, Georgia on November 16th, 2024. You can learn more and register for the marathon at everywomansmarathon.com.
Support for this show comes from Sylvan Learning. When children love learning, they can tackle any challenge life throws at them. Sylvan's Insight Assessment can help you determine if your child is ready for what's ahead. It can also identify gaps in learning and point out areas that could be of concern for your child so they can tackle what's to come. And right now, it's the best price of the year at $29. Go to sylvan29.com to learn more and get your child's assessment for only $29. That's sylvan29.com.
Hey, welcome to the Long Form Podcast. I'm Evan Ratliff from Atavist. I'm here with Max Linsky and Aaron Lammer from Long Form.
Hey.
Gentlemen.
Hey, guys.
Hey, welcome home, Max.
Hey, thanks a lot.
Where you been, Max?
I went to Boston this weekend to wish my grandmother a 100th birthday, a happy 100th birthday. She turned 100 on Saturday. And like 80 people from my family came all over the country, and we surprised her. And she really likes gambling, so we had a casino night. She played roulette. It was awesome.
How do you surprise someone who's 100? She's seen it all.
She was pretty surprised. She was pretty surprised. She was kind of shocked. And there was a lot of like, we can't surprise her too much or she might have a heart attack. So there was like a pre-surprise, like, there's many more people here than you know. We whispered that in her ear right before she walked into the room.
We should get her on the podcast, sounds like.
Let's call her. Evan, who did you talk to this week?
I talked to Amy Wallace, who is an LA-based writer for GQ, for Wired. She's written for a bunch of places. She's a wonderful writer, and she, in my opinion, is the kind of writer where you read her work and then you think she would be really fun to talk to, and actually she was. She's really interesting. She has a great perspective on this kind of work.
That's great, because I feel like my experience so often is just I'm totally let down by the guests.
Yeah, we won't say which ones.
Our sponsor this week is Warby Parker. It's a new concept in eyewear, and it's one that I am currently wearing on my face quite happily. Thank you, Warby Parker.
You guys, we have a second sponsor. It's Tiny Letter. It's a simple, elegant way to send an email newsletter. It's done by the good people at MailChimp. We thank them for their sponsorship.
Here is Evan and Amy Wallace.
Welcome to the Longform Podcast.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for coming in here. I was going to catch you in LA, but then it turned out you're going to be in New York anyway. So
yes, I'm here so we can do the sound booth thing.
Yeah, that's right. It wouldn't have been the same the same quality, the same intimacy.
Indeed.
If we'd done it out in LA. You've been based in LA for a long time. Do you find yourself pulled back to New York a lot, or are you sort of like a happy sort of satellite out there?
Both. I'm a happy satellite and I come back a lot.
Uh-huh.
But I love New York. I used to live here, and man, the past couple of days have just been reminding me why I loved it. You know, I've had a nice time here, remembering what it was like to live here. I lived here not right out of college, but a year out of college. My first job out of college was working as an assistant to a columnist at the New York Times in the Washington Bureau, James Reston.
How did you get that job?
I was an intern for Newsweek for 2 summers. Once in Washington, D.C., and once in San Francisco. And while I was an intern in Washington, D.C., I met a guy playing softball. He was on the New York Times team, and I was on the Newsweek team. And he said, I have this amazing job. I work for this columnist at the New York Times. I'm like right out of college, and I work at the New York Times for the big dog columnist. And I said, how do you get that job? And he said, well, he has this tradition where he's modeled it on the Supreme Court clerkships, and he has 1-year jobs for people right out of college. And instead of having an amazing executive assistant who runs his life with efficiency, he hires a college student, basically somebody who's just graduated from college, and you work for him for a year and help him with his columns and write for the Times when you can. And
wow.
And I was like, well, damn, where do I sign up for that? And I ended up applying for it and I ended up getting it. So the first job was there, and then I went up to New York after that and worked on the national desk, answering the phone, getting coffee, being a copy clerk, basically.
So once you were in, then you kind of
worked your way around. Came up here to New York, and that's when I lived here.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. I don't know if you want me to give the sort of chronology of how I became a magazine writer, but...
Actually, I kind of want to save that just for just a second, because I wanted to step back. The thing I actually wanted to start off asking you about, which maybe will get us into some of the stuff, was just that looking over all of the things you've written about,
mm-hmm.
there is an incredibly wide range. And I think it's rare for someone to go really deep into, say, business reporting and also go really deep into, say, Hollywood profiles, mm-hmm. and then into science writing. And I guess I wanted to find out if that felt like a natural evolution over your career. I follow what I'm interested in. I'm a generalist. Or if you feel like you have been sort of very specific in the way you've wanted to develop your career, the way you've wanted to, you know, go after certain subjects or educate yourself in certain areas or something like that.
It's definitely the former. I'm definitely a generalist journalist. And at times self-critically, like, should I focus more at one or the other? I was a Metro reporter for a long time. I covered riots and fires and earthquakes. I covered prisons when I was in Atlanta. We'll get to all of that, but I covered death row for a while and executions. For a long time I took jobs or gravitated towards assignments that I thought would teach me something when I was really younger and learning. And I need to learn how to seek out court documents. I need to learn how to cover a trial. Mm-hmm. This will be good. I'll do it. I don't care. I'll learn how to do that skill. Later, I have just gravitated to what interests me. The only place that's a little not a completely simple explanation is that celebrity profiles, in part, I do because I learned how to do them when I was a newspaper reporter at the LA Times. I thought if I was going to write about the movie industry, I needed to understand celebrity, mm-hmm. and I was not averse to doing them. Sometimes people think, they're just silly celebrity profiles. I thought, well, if I'm going to understand how Hollywood works, I need to get up close to some of this A-list stuff. So I developed the skill, and as a person who pieces together a career financially, if you can do that, it's one of the tools in your toolbox, mm-hmm. and it allows you to make a living. They're fairly quick hit stories, not always. I try to do a lot of secondary interviews, but some, you know, I just had a piece about Justin Timberlake in GQ, and it's mostly just an interview with Justin Timberlake.
Right.
You know, it's me and him, and so that can be time consuming to prepare for and time consuming to make happen. But it's almost like shooting a picture. Like once you got the interview in the can, you got to write it, but you're not out doing a huge amount more research. Advice to freelancers, if you can piece together a career where you do both ambitious stuff that feeds your soul and is nutritious, and you feel like you're doing something important or raising an important issue or uncovering an important story, but also if you only did that, it would be hard to eat,
mm-hmm.
because those stories can take a year or they can take 3 years. So,
and especially as a freelancer,
yes, exactly.
That money's not coming till the end, or actually well beyond the end of
exactly.
that story.
So I'm not saying I'm not interested in celebrity profiles. I am, and I'm constantly interested in the machinery around famous people and how they deal with fame. I'm not a snob at all about high culture, low culture. I think it's part of what makes our country. Something that people are definitely interested in. I'm interested in it too, but that I would admit that partly I do that for economic reasons as well, huh. not just my interest. But you're right. I mean, I've written about the anti-vaccine movement. I love true crime. I've written a lot of murder stories. I mean, I think the thing that unites all of them, and generally I turn any story that I'm working on, whether it's a celebrity profile or a biologist who murdered a bunch of people or Justin Timberlake, is there's a, it's almost trite to say, but there's a humanity to each of these people, and figuring out what's making them tick in the moment or in general is really interesting to me. So in a way, that's my sweet spot, and that's what I tend to gravitate towards.
The irony might be that it's sometimes more difficult to find the humanity in the celebrity than it is in the like person on death row.
Well, and often that's because you are only getting a, right. a very little bit of time right. with
you
them.
Got, you got 10 minutes to find the humanity in this world-renowned person. But something you just said about you decided to develop that skill when it comes to doing those kind of profiles. How do you do that? How do you sort of say, like, I'm going to try to bring my approach to this thing that I've never done before, profiling someone who maybe has been profiled 100 times and maybe I don't get much time with.
Right. I mean, I push for as much time as possible. Mm-hmm. I think the less time you have, the less you have to say always. I mean, but I mean, the thing that I say, I've talked to a lot of, you know, journalism classes, and the thing that I always say, sometimes young people think, who want to be celebrity journalists because it seems like it would be so much fun and so glamorous. And they think that if you sat them down with a celebrity right now, what they would think the right approach would be is to say, I'm such a fan of yours, that would be the in, that would be the convincing way of warming somebody up. And what I often say is the most flattering thing you can do to somebody, whether they are a music star or a scientist or whoever you're interviewing, a lawyer, is to have done your homework, which sounds kind of tedious. But when I sit down with somebody, I have generally read everything they've written if they're writers. I've listened to every piece of music if they're musicians. I've read everything that's ever been written about them. And what happens there is you don't announce that in the interview, but very early on, something comes up where they make a reference to something and you say, oh, wasn't that when you were, you know, in Thailand that time with the Buddha or whatever? And they look at you and they go, oh, okay, this is interesting. And sometimes that happens more than other times. But if you've really immersed yourself in the person, and I guess what I'm saying is I didn't know to do that in the beginning. I just thought it would be a good idea to prepare, you know, like we all do for interviews. But the more I do it, the more I'm convinced that that is really the way into somebody, even somebody who is very tired of talking about themselves, is very guarded because they're sick of reading about themselves. Movie stars sometimes are just tired of it. And they frankly want to do their acting. They don't want to talk about doing their acting. So, and I have some sympathy for that. I get it. But, you know, it's so that process, I think, is really. And the other thing that I do that I've talked about it before is when I can, I try to do secondary interviews before I reach the primary person.
So reporting around them.
Yeah. So, and for like when I profiled Gary Shandling, the comedian, partly because the interview kept getting delayed, I had talked to like 30 people about him. And I could say, not just as a name dropping technique, but I could say, well, you know, Robert Downey said that you blah, blah, blah. And, you know, I could provoke an answer by saying something that was said by somebody that he actually knows and somebody he's fond of or respects, or he's actually interested in hearing what Robert Downey had to say about him. He wants to know. So that I've stumbled on some sort of by accident sometimes, but you know, basically by my deadline approaching, my realizing I have to do all these interviews and I have to interview the subject, but okay, I'll do these other interviews first. But that often helps in the interview itself.
That Gary Shandling profile is one of the most interesting to me. I feel like that was one. I think I had read your stuff before, but I admit I'm not much. I don't like celebrity profiles in general. I don't like reading them. But then I'll read one and then I'll like peg someone as, okay, now I will read this person's, all of their celebrity profiles. And actually we've had on, Chris Heath is another one mm-hmm. that's that way. And Nancy Jo Sales is another one that is that way, that I feel like, okay, this is going to be, and it's something in the more, to me, a more almost like anthropological approach to who these people are. And I feel like the Shandling one was kind of like that. Like he's such a strange man, but also like he's this sort of like guru that all of these other people kind of come to is like he's the guru of comedy, which I never would have thought just kind of like seeing some of his comedy.
Yeah. No, I found that out before I did the profile. And so I realized that was going to be a theme. He didn't tell me. I just was hearing it, that people, there are a couple of guys in Hollywood that people use to, they screen their movies before them and they could take their feedback and they need that feedback. And I thought it was interesting that he was that guy for funny people.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, that was a really, I mean, he and I have talked about that profile a lot since.
Really?
Because that is really an example of a profile that we made together. I mean, maybe every profile gets made, you know, everybody has to participate and we're all doing our jobs. But I went to his house for the first, what I thought was going to be the only interview. And the peg for the story was that he was appearing in Iron Man 2, I believe. And he had been missing from action for 5 years. And I said, okay, so just one basic question is, why did you decide that Iron Man 2 is the project that was going to bring you back in front of the world's, you know, eyes?
Right, of all the things.
Yeah, of all the things. And this is actually described in the story, because he started to talk and he talked for an hour and he never answered the question. And he talked about, and I list all the things that he talked about, the love of a good woman, you know, God, it went on and on and on, from the mundane to the profound. But because I'm used to managing, part of the stress of a celebrity profile is, you know, you only have a certain amount of time and you have to manage that time. You got to get through all your stuff. And if you'd seen the body language between us, I was leaning farther and farther forward as he kept talking, because I was thinking, if he takes an hour to answer this question, I'm never going to get through these 75,000 other questions that I've brought, that I meticulously wrote down. And so I'm leaning towards him, and I'm starting to touch his like arm and saying, I'm saying, Gary, you have to answer the question, why Iron Man 2? And he was just loving it. And he was just riffing. And finally he said, you know, you can come back. And at that point I realized I was experiencing what it is to be with Gary Shandling.
Uh-huh.
And if I could come back, I was going to relax. And I literally just leaned back in my chair and let it roll over me, the Gary Shandling of it all. And he made good on that. Like we spent a lot of time together. And I then had the very satisfying experience of feeling like I actually did, to the extent one person can really understand another, I really did feel like I understood him.
Mm-hmm.
And could help you understand him, which is very satisfying. That's part of why I like writing profiles, when you can really achieve that.
Hey, this is Evan. I'm just pausing the interview for one moment. Regular listeners will know that we do this sometimes to talk about our sponsors, and I don't usually do it. I usually make Max do it because he's better at doing it. But in this particular case, I actually really like the sponsor, which is Warby Parker. I wear Warby Parker glasses. I also have a pair of sunglasses. And the reason is because when you're a glasses wearer and you want to go try to buy a pair of glasses that you think looks cool, you go into one of these designer eyewear stores, and then it costs like $600 when you get to the register, and it seems sort of ridiculous. And Warby Parker is kind of the solution to that, in that you can buy a pair of cool glasses and they cost $95. They will send you a bunch that you can try on, and then you find the ones you like and you send it back. And on top of that, when you buy one, they ship a pair to someone in the world who needs a pair of glasses, which is pretty cool. So if you want to check them out, there's a code, long form, that if you put it in and check out, they will give you expedited shipping. And we really appreciate their sponsorship this week. And now back to myself talking to Amy Wallace. There has to be something in that. I mean, it has to be on the part of the subject too, because you're dealing with a type of journalism that's often so transactional, you know. movie's coming out. I got 5 questions about the movie. What was it like to work with Robert Downey Jr.? And it's just kind of like they're just going to drone out their answers, as opposed to he has to make a decision. All right, I'm comfortable being myself, or I'm going to give this person more than I normally would. Mm-hmm. It seems like you have to kind of like make that happen, or else you're stuck with the same profile that everyone else has written.
Well, and that was a really good example of what made him do that, was that he saw that I had really done, I mean, it wasn't like I waved a flag saying I did all my homework, but there was an interaction early on where I saw a photograph in his kitchen and I said, is that, I'm not sure I'm pronouncing this right, but Thich Nhat Hanh, who's this monk and meditation teacher that I had read that he worked with. And but he kind of looked at me like, huh, you've gone there.
Right.
And it set things off on a good footing. You know, he felt taken seriously. So that's sort of the takeaway, is you don't have to flatter these people. Take them seriously. Everybody wants to be taken seriously. Nobel Prize winners want to be taken seriously. I mean, but their own spouses are sick of hearing them talk. But when we come in, you know, we're like, that's so interesting. And tell me more about that. And why did you make that choice? And why didn't you make that choice? And fundamentally, not all interviews are flattering. But the fact that we're coming in and saying, I really want to understand you in a profile situation, I think people, depending on the situation, people are flattered by that without you having to praise them.
Yeah. Well, to go from that to, I feel like we're going from like the lightness of Gary Shandling down deeper. I wanted to talk a little bit about the most recent. I don't know if the Justin Timberlake one's the most recent or the.
They kind of came out the same week. Yeah. The boy who killed his neo-Nazi father.
Yeah, the boy who killed his father. So that story is also, I know, because we actually tried to sign that story at the Atavist.
Really?
Yeah, but it's one of those where we sort of, kind of, we had that inkling, you know, someone else is on this, and maybe we're not going to be the ones to get it, so we ended up letting it drop. But that's one interesting aspect of it, is that that's been a while. So you've been on that story.
I worked on that story for more than a year.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, off and on. I was doing other things as well, but his trial started last October, and we're now in November. So it has been more than a year. Yeah, that was a really heartbreaking story.
How did you sort of, how did you kind of work your way into that story?
You know, that's a situation where, you know, I couldn't talk to the boy.
Yeah.
He's in juvenile detention. And just to sum it up for people who haven't heard it, it's a 10-year-old boy whose father was a leader of a neo-Nazi group, the National Socialist Movement, NSM, in Southern California. And one night he got up in the middle of the night and he got dad's gun, which was always lying around loaded, and shot his dad in the head. He was on trial for murder as a juvenile. And I basically entered at the trial stage.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, so I could see him. I could see him reacting in the courtroom and was there for much of the testimony, and then got some of the expert testimony, like on, you know, I got it transcribed and had that as well. And then I got to know his grandmother a little bit and did a lot of research about the National Socialist Movement and sort of and why the Riverside and that whole San Bernardino County area is such a hotbed to the extent that it is for that kind of belief system.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of it's about poverty and
mm-hmm.
no options. And one of the important elements of reporting that story also was there was a woman, Julie Plattner, who had been following the father, Jeff Hall, around hoping to make a documentary of him. And she had a huge amount of footage of him.
Uh-huh.
And in fact, what drew our attention, Brendan, my editor at GQ, and I, to the story was that the New York Times wrote this front page story about it, because there had been a New York Times reporter following Jeff around to do a story about neo-Nazism or something. And he had been with them the day before the killing happened. But Julie was the one that had taken that reporter into that story. And there are pictures that ran in the New York Times that Julie had taken.
Oh, I see.
So I tracked Julie down and watched all her footage. So I saw Jeff interacting with his son, even though Jeff was dead. And I saw sort of that dynamic, which is a rare, you know, when you pick it up at the trial stage, you know, there are missing people already. You know, there's somebody who's already gone.
Yeah. And especially the interaction between, in this case, the killer and the victim.
Yeah. And we don't, there's not that much of that in the story. There's more, what it did show me was that I think Jeff Hall loved his kids. You know, he had, you know, questionable judgment about certain things, but he was very involved in his kids. And it was just a really complicated situation because Joseph, his son, was really damaged for a lot of reasons. And that was the quandary of the trial, which was what, as we say in the story, what to do with Joseph. You know, because he's a juvenile, he will be back out among us in 10 years and when he's 23. And how do you get somebody help who's going to be back out among us, you know, who was dealt the worst of all possible hands in terms of drug abuse in utero, perhaps in terms of probably some sort of, whether it's attention deficit or I don't know what sort of damage that happened to him that he was struggling with in terms of being able to do well in school. And so there was a lot of anger and then, you know, there were guns around. So there was that.
And that was, you know, that was a factor.
Yeah, Nazi meetings happening in the house and a lot of rhetoric, and he'd been taken down to the border to learn how to shoot. And so he really just was dealt the worst of all hands.
And you have a son and you know, there's ways that you could sort of like relate to the story, but do you feel like you generally keep yourself at some remove from the story? You're not a huge like first person writer
actually,
in a lot of ways.
I go first person in that piece at one point.
Yeah.
You know, it's funny on the sort of to step back from that whole issue. You know, there are certain ways of going first person, often in celebrity profiles, that I've often hated, which are like, then I ordered the Caesar salad and she ordered the blah, blah, blah. The first time that I met her, Meg Ryan or whoever.
A lot of that is just the lack of things to talk about. You're just like stretching out some lunch.
It often is the person did not get very much. And so they're describing the argument in favor of that is, hey, they got to be with this person. So they're telling us what it's like. But often it feels like padding. That said, I have put myself, sometimes it's the way the person is interacting with you that is interesting.
Yeah.
So when Justin Timberlake is telling me that, I don't know if we can cuss on this. But,
yes, we can.
When he's telling me that it's really interesting that I'm interviewing him about the Men of the Year issue when he feels like literally a bunch of people just took a shit on my face. He has to say that to me, and there has to be in other words, it's not a sort of disembodied quote you can put somewhere. He's saying it to me, and
right.
It feels, wow, I've never heard Justin Timberlake say anything like that.
It was a great Twitter, that was a fantastic Twitter quote to have. That thing's easy to spread.
Yeah. So, I mean, I got him on a bad day. I mean, or a good day. I mean, I think he chose to articulate himself that way. He was mad and he wanted to tell somebody about it. But it depends.
Yeah.
It depends. But I am briefly in the Joseph thing because I think that I kind of had to say, like, you find yourself feeling like this when you are in the courtroom looking at this boy.
Yeah.
You know, and just describing it, although I'm a fan of that kind of more removed, sort of just purely observational, it felt in this case, particularly since Jim Nelson, the editor in chief of GQ, had urged me to make this more of a almost essay and like a discussion of the issues raised, as opposed to just a rat-a-tat-tat crime story, which I think was the right call. And then once it had that tone, which is kind of kicked off at the end of the first section, which says, you know, it seemed simple, but it was anything but. There was a voice of almost essay quality.
Yeah.
So then I could live in that story a little bit more. I'm not in it very much, but.
And then, I mean, I guess part of what I was getting to was, does the story live with you? I mean, do you, the story just
does
came out, so it's been done
me?
For
yeah.
a while. So, but do you wake up thinking about this kid, or, you know, is it easy to sort of dip into that and come out of it and move on to something lighter? Or how much does it sort of like accumulate on you?
That's a good question. I mean, I definitely made me, it sticks with me. It's a story that doesn't, you know, when you think about the elements in it, it's hard to feel anything but sadness about it. I mean, I've had different experiences. This goes back to the beginning of my career, but when I covered prisons for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution.
Now, this was, so let's get from Times to
there. From the New York Times, the person who had been the Washington Bureau Chief of the New York Times when I worked for there for a year, was a man named Bill Kovich. And he ended up leaving the New York Times and going to become the editor-in-chief of the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. And with him, he took many young people who wanted to be full-time reporters and were tired of getting coffee in the hopes of someday becoming reporters.
Mm-hmm.
So I was one of, I think, five or six of us who went from the New York Times clerkship program down to Atlanta. And my first beat was covering prisons. And at that time, and I think to this day, Georgia kills people in the electric chair on a regular basis.
And worse, they're up there with Florida.
So the way covering executions worked was if the murder, generally it was a murder that somebody was being executed for, had happened in your county, the newspaper in that county could get a seat to witness an mm-hmm. execution. And I was very sort of strident and young and female and trying to prove that I was tough and not a sissy. And so when a time came up for me to witness, I said, I'm absolutely witnessing. If the state of Georgia is going to kill people, I think the Atlanta Journal-Constitution should show people what that looks like. So my boss, the managing editor, assistant managing editor for Metro at that point, said, who was a really tough guy, Sonny Rawls, he said, what are you doing that for? And I was like, because we cover this and we should show it. And he said, I don't want that memory in my mind. You don't need to do this. And I was like, no, I'm going to do this. I'm doing it. So I watched Timothy McCorkadale be electrocuted. And I wrote a huge story about how it works and how the chair, first there's a surge of 2,000 volts, and then there's another one 10 seconds later. And we went to town. If we're going to do this as a society, that's fine. Let's just look at what it looks like and what you actually do. And a couple of weeks after I watched it, I had a really weird dream that I don't think I've ever had a dream like this where everything in the dream was red and the visuals were just people I loved looking at me in the face and turning away from me, like shaking their heads, and it was a very upsetting dream. And I woke up thinking, what the hell was that? And at least my analysis of that dream, you can be the judge, doctor, but was ultimately that I think that's what I was imagining it felt like to be on death row, that people turn away from you. They say you are the monster. You know, you aren't just a person who made a mistake. You are the other. And we excommunicate you from society and we kill you too. And that's how my brain sort of processed that experience. While in the moment I was very, you know, taking notes and making sure, and the leather strap
the
was
reporter.
On the ankle, and then the blindfold went on the da-da-da, and I was all in the details of reporting my job. But stories do have an impact.
That's
on
that
you.
One's obviously stuck with you.
Yeah,
that's
oh, yeah.
been a while. I mean, what year was that?
That was 1988, maybe.
Did you ever witness another execution?
No, that's the only one I witnessed. One was plenty.
And so how did you were covering prisons in Atlanta, and then how did you sort of move on from there? Did you go straight to LA Times from there?
I went straight to the LA Times. Well, Bill Kovich, who we'd all followed to the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, quit. This is the short version. and
sounds like a more interesting story.
Yeah, there's a long story there. And actually, it's a public record. He was feeling pressure from the Cox sisters who owned the paper. Mm-hmm. And the paper ended up winning a Pulitzer for a series on redlining, but was doing great work. But in any case, suddenly the person we'd followed was no longer running the paper. Mm-hmm. And so
unfortunately, they succeeded in turning the paper into what it is today.
Well, and that was, we thought, clearly about to happen. And so a bunch of us headed for the exits. And mm-hmm. I'd been covering a congressional race at that point, and the election had just happened, and I was already going to California for a vacation. And I quickly sent my resume to the Los Angeles Times, the San Jose Mercury. There might have been another one. And I interviewed while I was on vacation. And I ended up, it took a while, but I ended up getting a job at the LA Times. And I worked there for a long time. I was a reporter there for 11 years. Yeah.
And how did you make the transition from being a newspaper reporter? I mean, you mentioned like the frustrations of having to sort of learn things on deadline, but what prompted the decision to sort of make the jump? Did you start you did some magazine pieces while you were still on staff?
I did. Well, at that point, the Los Angeles Times had a magazine,
right?
Which it no longer does. And there was a great editor there, Kit Rackless, who I worked with on several magazine pieces. And then Kit ended up leaving and going to be the editor-in-chief of Los Angeles Magazine, and I followed him and became a full-time magazine writer then. And mm-hmm. really sort of my education was really full-time at that point. The thing that I felt was, you know, there's so much about newspaper reporting, and I admire it still, and I still subscribe, and I'm, you know, an advocate, and I'm sad about what's happening to a lot of newspapers. But for me, I felt like you could say more in a magazine, and I don't just mean space-wise. I mean some of these things we've been discussing, you know, point of view change, or including yourself when appropriate, or mm-hmm. or stepping back. There was an amazing story that another writer at LA Magazine, who had come with me from the LA Times, and he and I used to talk about it all the time, which was a Ron Suskin piece in the New York Times Magazine, where he profiled the press secretary for President Bush. And he caught her at sort of a time when she was making a huge transition. And during the reporting, she steps down and she decides to go back to her life in Texas, I think. And he's in the lead. The reporter is in the lead. And he's describing how awkward it is to be in the house and how there's these awkward silences as he waits for her to come downstairs and he's talking to the husband. I'm not doing it justice at all. But we would talk about this story. Like,
we'll put it in the reference to it in the show notes.
It's fascinating how he's telling us so much more by describing that than if he just quoted what they said and told us what their house looked like. He's explaining the awkwardness of this situation, this moment she finds herself in, and that her family finds themselves in. And if we talked about that story for 10 minutes, we talked about it for 500 minutes. Like, we just were, it was what we were trying to learn to do. And the person I was talking with for 500 minutes was Jesse Katz, who's a great, great magazine writer. But we were new at it. And we were fascinated by that idea that you could actually say more of the truth when you acknowledged, and this was the key thing, when you acknowledge what you didn't know. Mm. In the story, when you acknowledge when you were confused, or when you acknowledged that you couldn't get to the bottom of it, or that you were, there's a great Dave Gardetta story called Hooking Up, in which he tries to explore the youth culture of what is hooking up. And at one point in the story, he basically says, I don't know what hooking up means. I mean, he says it much more eloquently than that, but he says, to some people, hooking up is this. Some people, hooking up is that. And it's both a hilarious paragraph, but it actually says more about what hooking up, the role that phrase plays in the culture, than if you actually nailed down a definition. Right. And that really interested me. And I felt like magazine writing lit that happen.
Two sort of business related things. You worked for Portfolio Magazine, which I wanted to touch on just a little bit because mm-hmm. that seems like just an interesting experience. And you also wrote a column for the New York Times, which was about innovation. But the Portfolio thing, were you a staff writer at Portfolio?
I was, yeah.
And did it feel like you were like riding a gold-plated train to paradise, and then it like went off a cliff, or like what? I'm interested in sort of the experience of being inside of something like that, that sort of like launches out of nowhere.
Well, it definitely had a lot of resources. It was definitely a well-funded entity, and a beautiful magazine. It looked fantastic. I mean, I wasn't actually inside the belly of the beast because I was always in Los Angeles.
Right.
I was always based out on the left coast. But I wouldn't say that it felt fantastic and then suddenly we went off a cliff. I think everybody knew that things were not working as they should have.
Mm-hmm.
The basic thing about Portfolio was it was a very high-end business magazine that was launched at a time when everybody was cutting back on their high-end advertising. That's the short version of why it went down. But it was also a business magazine that was trying to figure out what it was. And that was difficult for a lot of people who were working there.
Mm-hmm. And in terms of, I mean, you've been now, I guess, a freelancer really since then, and you were sort of, seems like prior to then. And I think a lot of people would look now, especially younger people, and say, if you're going to try to raise a family, that being a freelancer is either incredibly difficult or untenable.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm curious if your sort of approach to it is that you value your freedom a certain amount and your and the other aspects of life, or if you're sort of like, no, actually, I've figured out how to piece together the income I need to like live the life I want to live. You know what I mean?
I wish it were the latter. Yes, I've figured it out, everyone. It's all, I'll just give you my secrets. Well, let me say this. I have several jobs right now. I work half-time at Los Angeles Magazine. I'm editor at large, which, mm-hmm. as far as I'm concerned, is the best title I will ever have. And I love all the people there. And the great thing about that is that it gives me, in addition to working with great editors, Mary Melton, the editor-in-chief, is fantastic. It gives me a community. And I'm not a person who's very happy when I'm just sitting in my house.
Hmm.
Sometimes I like sitting in my house. But to not have any sort of place to get up and go to is not good for my psyche, I've found. So I have that. And I am a correspondent for GQ. So I owe them a certain number of words a year. And then I freelance from there.
Mm-hmm.
And as we were talking about before we started recording, I've also helped an executive at Pixar, Ed Catmull, write a book, which is going to come out in April. So again, I guess that fits into the generalist sort of trying to have lots of tools in my toolbox.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's important if you want to feed yourself and your family. I've been very fortunate, I mean, in terms of having opportunities. But, you know, for example, the New York Times prototype column, it was called, about innovation, how that occurred was when I was at Portfolio, an editor at the Sunday New York Times business section had approached me about possibly working there. And that didn't work out, but we had started this dialogue. And so when Portfolio closed and I had a story that was supposed to appear in, I think it was the June, maybe July issue, that was now not going to be printed.
Mm-hmm.
I had this finished, very long story. I went straight to him and said, will you run this? I have a baby that has no home. And it needs to run quickly. Like I needed it. It was going to become, if I went to another national magazine, first of all, they'd be like, whatever, we didn't assign this. But also, it needed to be birthed.
Mm-hmm.
And he ran it. He opened up much of the section for it on a Sunday. And I ended up doing a couple of more freelance pieces for him. And then he asked me if I wanted to do this column. So, I mean, again, one of the things that I say to young people about freelancing is don't underestimate how valuable it is to make your deadline, be professional and accurate, do what you say you're going to do, and play well with others. Some of those things are very boring sounding, like, well, that's not brilliant. I want to be brilliant. Well, I want to be brilliant too. But the way you make a career is you get the job done and you do it when you said you were going to do it. And you're intellectually honest and you do anything to make the story good. And when you do that, people want to work with you again, even if it's been hard, you
mm-hmm.
know. Now, what does that mean for your life? I mean, the number of jobs I just described to you, I don't recommend it.
Yeah.
It was too many at one point. And now the book is finished and it's going to be out in April. Creativity Inc. is what it's called. And it's going to be great. And it was Ed's, you know, it's his sort of his life's work and how Pixar manages its creative culture. It's cool. But when I was doing that and several other things at once, I took a 6-month book leave, but, you know, frankly couldn't afford to take much more than that. And, you know, that the upside is that I have freedom so I can work when I decide to, mm-hmm. as opposed to you have to be at your desk from 9 to 5. But it does mean that I ended up working, you know, a lot of time, you know, weekends and nights and things like that. And that's still true to a certain degree, even with the book being done. You know, that is the freelancer life. If it's due on Monday, you don't get to take the weekend off. You're going to be writing it on Saturday and Sunday. But as you say, it comes with freedom. You just have, it's a juggling act to a certain degree.
Yeah. Well, the last thing, this is somewhat related, but not exactly, that I was going to ask you about earlier, but I just wanted to get it in, and then I'll let you go. Was you wrote this story about Amy Bishop, who's the professor who was who ended up killing a number of her colleagues in a shooting rampage, basically, for Wired magazine, which I love that story. It's such a really, really fantastic story. Mm. I think it's one of the best Wired stories of ever.
Thank you.
And
I know where you're headed.
But one thing that really interested me was I interviewed Patrick Radden Keefe, uh-huh. who subsequently wrote a story for The New Yorker uh-huh. about Amy Bishop. And you were very gracious about it. I felt like people asked you, obviously, about it, or it came up. And I think you sort of said, like, yeah, it was a great piece, and here's my piece. And I can't remember mm-hmm. exactly what you said mm-hmm. on Twitter. I meant to go back and look it up. But
mm-hmm. People tweeted, like, damn, you know, like, you got robbed kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And what is your like feeling about that sort of thing? Like, what is your feeling of sort of ownership of a story like that or
I mean, so the woman opens fire in a staff meeting, kills three people, savagely injures I think three more. And the murders happen, and I went in while she was going to trial.
Yeah.
And I was closer to the event than he was. And so the big get that he got that I didn't get was talking to the parents.
Because it had been a long time.
So. And I think also it probably didn't hurt that he was coming from The New Yorker. You know, I mean, I think there are certain places that people, I don't know whether this had an impact on them, but there are certain places that definitely where when you say you're coming from there, people are... Well, this we're going to talk to anyone. It's going to be this place. But either way, I tried to talk to them. They were not ready to talk. And I reached out. I had email addresses. I tried, and I didn't get them. And he did. And that was really interesting. I mean, you know, none of these stories are ours. They're somebody else's. Now, we can do our great job, hopefully, explaining them or, you know, delving into them. It's hard to watch one of your stories be told again, but I definitely exchanged some emails with my editor at Wired that day when The New Yorker came out with their story. But at the same time, you know, we'd had our moment with that story, and we had the thing we were proudest of was that I got all of the copies of her novels that were unpublished, and so you got kind of a glimpse into her psyche to the extent we could deduce things from those novels, because some of them were very violent and some of them talked about depression. And so we'd had our moment with the story, and then I don't think that means that no one else can ever write about it again. But, you know, it's hard to watch sometimes. It can be hard to watch.
Yeah, it's just interesting as a reader because, you know, you can sort of see, you can almost like see a way into the process a little bit, because uh-huh. you can look at the first story and say, I can see why they put the story out then. You know, that was as much as you were going to get.
Yes.
And you could sit on it for a long time, but it was time to tell that story. And you could also see why someone sitting at the New Yorker said, well, now it's been longer, maybe we can get something else. And as a reader, you kind of want the two of you to get together and like write something together.
I would welcome that. I would. I mean, I've been the beneficiary of that same thing in a much different way. But there was a great, great spin story about D'Angelo, the soul singer, about his fall from grace.
Oh, yeah.
And it was just a great piece of journalism. But that writer never got D'Angelo because D'Angelo was off the grid. He wasn't talking to anybody. So when I heard that D'Angelo was going on tour, this is now 18 months ago, maybe 2 years ago, after 13 years outside, you know, the next Marvin Gaye, the greatest soul singer ever, had fallen off the side of the world for 13 years. People knew where he was, but he wasn't seen in public and he didn't perform. And when I heard he was going on tour in Europe to kind of warm up to get for his comeback, I immediately emailed Jim Nelson at GQ, who's a huge music fan. And I said, please send me, please, 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 please send me, you know? And so I ended up going on tour with D'Angelo and ended up getting the interview.
What's the comeback?
And I heard from the writer at Spin afterwards. And, you know, he was like, I mean, I'm sure it was really hard
for him. I mean, he was saying,
of course it was
I
hard
did that
for him
story.
To read. Well, not just I did that story, but I wanted that interview,
yeah.
You know, and I totally understood. I mean, he didn't say that to me. He was nothing but gracious. He was totally gracious. But so, you know, you're in the right place at the right time, or you get lucky, or, you know, and in that moment, that was another D'Angelo story. Like, they're both good. They're just at different moments, you know. But I heard from the guy, you know, and I totally, you know, I was so appreciative that he was so, you know, he was so laudatory of the story. And I was like, your story was so great. It helped me so much, because it did. I mean, I went to people that he had quoted in his story and interviewed them because I knew to interview them from his story. I mean, absolutely.
Yeah.
There was like, he had gone inside this moment, which I wouldn't have known about as much if he hadn't done that. So I guess we're all building on each other's work to a certain degree.
Yeah, and you're right. Ultimately, that's D'Angelo's story. It's actually not.
Well, that's,
not,
I mean,
it's not anyone's story except his.
It's something I'm thinking about a lot, actually, when I think about, you know, I've co-written a book now, and will I write my own book? Would I like to do that? I think I would, but what do I want to do it about? And what I tend to write stories about often are, I get people to tell me about their lives. But those are their stories. That's not my, but you know, so unless I'm going to write a memoir, I'm going to be asking people to tell me their stories. And I'm thinking a lot about that. You know, it's one thing if you write a big idea book that's like, my idea is X, and I'm going to go out and talk to 12 people mm-hmm. about that. But the stories I tend to write, at least at the moment, are more taking you inside somebody's world. And so I'm sort of pondering what that means for book writing.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Well, I want you to keep doing it, for one. So
well, thank you.
Don't change.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for coming to New York to do this. It wasn't why you came to New York,
the minute you asked me, I flew here.
But thanks for coming in here, and it's been really fun. So
thank you.
We'll have you
it.
Back again, maybe after that book comes out, or
that'd be great.
Maybe when your book comes out.
Ooh, the one I haven't decided on
yet. That's no problem. You need another job.
I don't need an excuse to come in here. I'll talk to you for another hour.
All right. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Long Form Podcast. I'm Evan Ratliff. I was the host this week. I was talking to Amy Wallace, who was really gracious to come into the studio in New York and really fun to talk to. My co-hosts are Max Linsky and Aaron Lammer from longform.org. Our wonderful editor is Lauren Kirchner. Our intern is Gavin Jenkins. And our sponsors were Warby Parker and Tiny Letter. Thanks to both of them. And check us out next week. We really appreciate your listenership.
Why do you run? Why does anyone?
I always thought that runners loved running, and that's not the case. Most runners hate running, but they choose to do it.
In the new docuseries, Running Sucks, brought to you by Team Milk
Abby Ayers learns why women runners everywhere are driven to go the distance.
It really is about taking my power back and proving myself wrong.
Team Milk is about fueling women's performance and helping them along their marathon journeys. You can sign up now for the inaugural Every Woman's Marathon taking place in Savannah, Georgia on November 16th, 2024. Learn more and register at everywomansmarathon.com.